minutes ago. I'm looking real good in my passport photo.
Amateur Traveler, episode 766. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about rapids and waterfalls, canyons and dories, hikes and ancient Puebloans as we go rafting in the Grand Canyon. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Let's talk about the Grand Canyon. I'd like to welcome to the show Randy Rohr from Baltimore, Washington, and Robin Perry from Rock Hill, South Carolina, who are also patrons of the show, but that's not why we have them on. We have them on to talk about the Grand Canyon and rafting the Grand Canyon. I'm going to do this in the opposite order now. Robin and Randy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
Thanks, Chris. It's great to be here. Longtime fan of the show.
Well, and this episode actually came out of, I talk about on the show that we do a monthly Zoom call with patrons of the show, those who can show up. And last time we were talking about travels and what people have been doing recently. And Robin, you just got back from a Grand Canyon trip not that long ago.
In June, we rafted down the Grand Canyon, and it was a very unexpected trip because of people not being able to travel due to COVID. There were cancellations, and I think it was just in March that we were able to schedule our trip, and we were able to go in June. So kind of a quick turnaround for this kind of a trip, and it was just fantastic.
Well, when we pulled in Randy, not because Randy went with Robin or that they've spent a lot of time with each other, but Randy, you have been done this trip or a trip like it 10 times, as I recall.
Well, actually, I have done it 9 times, but I'm planning to go on my 10th trip coming up next month. And when I heard Robin say that she had just got back, I got very excited because rafting Grand Canyon is one of my favorite trips to do.
So I've got 2 questions, one for each of you. We'll start with you, Robin. So you mentioned this was unexpected. The normal wait time for a reservation to get on a trip for the Grand Canyon is what?
My understanding is about 1 to 2 years because the National Park Service only issues so many passes per year, so it's a limited number, and that you really do have to plan ahead for this type of a trip.
And then, Randy, I got to ask, 10 times is rather a lot. Are all of those 10 trips the same?
Yes and no. All these trips traverse the same length and area of the canyon and the river, but no trip is ever the same. It's okay. Always different weather, different stops, visiting different places. It's different every time.
Okay. Well, and then when we talk about differences, and you guys can stop me if I'm wrong here, I can think of at least 4 different types of trips that one can do in the same part of the river. I can do a paddle trip where I've got a paddle in my hand. I can do an oar trip where the guide has got great big oars. I can do a motorized boat, or I can do a dory if I'm particularly crazy, which is a wooden boat. Am I missing a type of trip?
That's basically it. You got it. Sometimes the modern day dories are actually more fiberglass than wood. But basically, that's right. Those are the 4 basic type of boats that are used in the river.
Okay. And Robin, you did...
We did a motorized, what's called a J-rig, and actually the outfitter that I went with.
You could mention the outfitter.
So Western River, okay. Expeditions, and this is a motorized craft that they have patented. So what's one thing I learned on the river is even on the motorized crafts, which are much bigger than the smaller rafts, they're different kinds. So this one, the unique design is it's 5 like pontoons strapped together, straddled together very securely. And then in the center, there's kind of what creates then a bench seat, which about 6 people could sit on looking forward. And in the back, it was so cute. There was an area they called either the chicken coop or the princess pad. So certainly that sounds, it's much, much safer and you hardly got wet. But the adventurous folks, when you wanted to, you were rafting and going through the rapids, straddling those pontoons in the front. So you really had a variety of seating on that J-rig. So that was a unique design that they offer.
Hmm. And now, Randy, your 9 trips that you've done and the 10th one that's coming, all on the same type of trip or different?
They were all non-motorized rafts.
Okay.
And many companies run what they will refer to as a hybrid trip, where they'll have four or five oar-powered rafts and then maybe a paddle boat as well.
Okay.
So some people love to paddle all the time and want to always be in the paddle boat. Some people never want to be in the paddle boat and want to be in the oar boat. And then you always have the option of switching out from day to day or morning to afternoon. So you can get a variety and a feel for the different boats. And so all my trips have all been this combination of paddle boats and oar boats. And sometimes they will take a little one-person ducky along.
The inflatable kayaks.
Inflatable kayak. Mm-hmm. And for some of the smaller rapids, they will let you paddle a ducky through some of the smaller rapids. But when it gets to the bigger rapids, they usually don't want you in a little ducky.
Right. Well, and we have done one episode of this very trip before an amateur traveler. You're going to have to go way back to find it in the archives. And we did it with the founder of Oars, which is another outfitting company, George Wendt, who is no longer living. He died a few years back. But he talked about this particular trip. And then at the end of that show, I asked him, what other trips do you recommend for people who can't get on or don't have the time to do this trip? Because this is like a week-long trip. Is that about right?
Mine was 6 days. I think, Randy, yours is probably much longer.
Yeah, usually the non-motor trips are longer because they're slower and take more time. Mm-hmm. So my trips were anywhere from 12 days to 18 days, kind of generally in the 2 week range if you're doing the full canyon in a non-motor boat.
Got it. Well, and I asked George at the end of that episode, what was his favorite trip that was a rafting trip in the U.S. that was not the Grand Canyon? He had recommended the Gates of Lodore in Dinosaur National Park in Colorado, which we talked about on a recent episode of the show. When I did that trip with him, which he graciously offered after that episode, I spent a lot of time in the duckies. I spent a lot of time on that river in the inflatable kayaks because it's great fun if they let you do it. But yeah, there are definitely some rafts even on that trip where they said, yeah, no, back in the boat. Our liability insurance will not cover you going through this rapid on a kayak. So, excellent. Well, and my understanding is the difference in the length between the two is not that you go through the rapids faster in the motor boat, but there's time in between the rapids that is faster if you could just, turn on the motor and zoom down.
Yeah. And I wouldn't say the motorized is zooming. I think it might be going, I forget, it was like 8 to 10 knots per hour. It's not going very fast. Yeah. Right. But we would be passing some of the smaller rafting boats and the dories. They certainly were taking a much more leisurely time. Although I will tell you, there was one time they were awfully glad we were there. One of the small rafts got stuck going through a rapid on one of the rocks.
Got wrapped.
Yes. And so they're trying to rock it out. And so we were hanging back and kind of just keeping our place and holding space until they could try and get themselves off, but they couldn't. And so then our guide decided, okay, if he positioned our boat a certain way through the rapid, we could displace enough water, and we lifted them up and moved them on. So they were very glad that we came along with our motorized boat. So, yeah.
Well, and yeah, we'll get to dangers in a little bit, but that's going to be one that we're going to talk about is wrapping.
Yeah, contrary to a lot of people's beliefs, a lot of the Grand Canyon is flat water. Mm-hmm. Yes, there are a lot of rapids, but between many of the rapids are very slow, sometimes almost like a lake. And you actually have to motor or paddle to make it across the lake to the next rapid. Yes, the river is big and flowing and moving, but it's not always very fast. I don't know what the exact percentage is, but it's only a very, very small percentage of the river are rapids.
Well, I want to get some of the highlights of the experience. Then I want to talk about some of the dangers that people would worry about and the prep and those sorts of things. But if I ask you first, each of you, for a highlight, and we'll start with you, Robin, because it's a little fresher in your mind. What stands out as the single best moment where you thought, I am so glad I did this?
That's such a hard question, Chris.
Yep.
Okay. Yep. Okay, to pick one, but there were many. The one is just the magnificence when you are sitting on that raft and looking everywhere around you and just seeing the walls of the canyon that are just breathtaking, speechless. Obviously, they're so gorgeous, and that it is such a huge, huge canyon. I know, having been to the South Rim was my only other experience before, and I thought mm-hmm. it was big. I saw nothing. I mean, compared the 188 miles, you know, I lived in the Northeast for a long time. That's like Boston to Albany is what I rafted and did not do the whole thing. So the magnificence of it is just what I could not get over.
I had never put that in perspective of how long that is. Okay. Except a little more windy. It's not 188 miles straight. Okay.
Right. Right. The rafting part is 188 miles that I did. And that's not the whole canyon.
Right. Yeah. You put in at
Lee's Ferry.
And then you came out again at where?
Randy, you had reminded me where I came out.
If I recall, I believe it's Whitmore Wash.
Yes.
Helicopter people out.
So you helicopter people out from there. Okay. Excellent. And then, Randy, you had 9 trips. So you thought this was a hard question, Robin. Randy, 9 trips, best moment.
Oh, my. So many. Probably on one trip, in the middle of the night, we climbed this one peak. There was a full moon. We turned our headlamps off and hiked up to the top of this butte in time for sunrise as it came over the eastern skyline. This temple was called the Tabernacle. Hmm. It's a popular hike that you do on trips, or some people do on trips. And so we were just had the right conditions where, starting at 3 or 4 in the morning, we hiked up at night under the moonlight, didn't turn our headlamps on, and we're up on top in time for the sunrise as it swept out over the canyon rim.
Hmm. And that reminds me, when we were having this conversation, that was interesting enough that I said, oh, hey, we need to do this and record it. You were mentioning that for you, some of the highlights weren't on the river, that they were these hikes.
Exactly.
And I don't know that people are picturing that.
The river can be used as kind of a big backpacking trip in the sense that mm-hmm. you traverse down the river, and a lot of the interest of the trip are side hikes up these side canyons that you could not get to, or at least it'd be very, very difficult to get to without coming from the river and from the river trip. And so I always tell people it's as much a hiking trip as it is a rafting trip. And how much hiking you do can vary depending on the trip and the people on the trip and mm-hmm. how much time you have. I kind of consider the non-motor trips are usually have a little bit more time and are a little bit less of a hurry. And they often have a little bit more time to spend time hiking. And to me, hiking is really one of the top highlights of a lot of these trips. And it's a wide variety. Some may be just a short stop to look at a petroglyph or mm-hmm. fossils along the river. Some might be a hike up, maybe a half-mile hike up to a waterfall off of a side canyon. And I've been on a trip where we had a lot of interest in hiking, and we had done a layover day, 2 nights at the same camp, and we did an all-day hike, like 12 hours. And by the time I got to the boats, I was extremely exhausted. But the nice thing is, as far as hiking, there's something for everyone. Usually there's multiple options. For the people who really, really want to hike, they can split the group up and do like an all-day hike. They might have a medium-length hike. Some people will only want or be able to do short hikes. And then the one thing that the guides always said is, this is your vacation. You can do what you want. If someday you don't feel like doing one of the hikes, you can just sit by the river and read a nice book and enjoy yourself. There's a lot to offer for a lot of different interests, especially in terms of hiking.
Well, and then, Robin, you were on the shorter trip. Did you do that much hiking?
I would say what we did was more the shorter walks. I mean, sure. Every day we did a shorter walk, typically to a waterfall, which was amazing how much water there is to the side of the canyon and mm-hmm. coming in. And we were very appreciative of those because it was 115 degrees. We hit the heat wave this past June. And so it was very hot. You could get definitely cooled off in the river because that river water is 50 to 55 degrees. Mm-hmm. But it was nice with the side waterfalls and lagoon areas. You could really swim and just kind of relax in the water. So I would say ours were shorter walks into some beautifully scenic areas. And there were an option a couple of days that people did longer hikes. My husband did a much longer hike up to the source of Deer Creek Falls, which was, the pictures were splendid. I was just too tired that day.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what's nice. There's options depending how you feel that day and what you would like to do.
Well, and Randy, you mentioned petroglyphs, and it seems odd to think that people lived in this because it's difficult to get to, but that also, of course, made it very remote and isolated and, of course, a source of water right there. But we're talking about petroglyphs from, I assume, the ancient Puebloans, or what we used to call the Anasazi.
Yes, exactly. In fact, many of them lived seasonally in the canyon.
Oh, seasonally. Interesting.
Yeah. Some, you know, and the other belief is at that time, which is, I believe, in the 1400s, early 1500s, they believed that the climate was different then and more amenable. Some would live there, but many would migrate seasonally, spend different times of the season growing crops and bringing crops. And some of the stops along the way, you can find granaries where they used to store their crops and things like that.
And we had hiked up to an area where they lived and saw like the foundations of living areas and then also pieces of pottery and cooking utensils. Mm. And it's just all nicely just laid out and everyone just looks at it and just leaves it. There's so much history that you learn actually as you raft, both the history and then the geology. I found the guides are just fantastic with their knowledge. So there's so much learning that goes on in this too.
Excellent. You mentioned being 117 degrees. I want to get back to that because I think a lot of people have been to the Grand Canyon. Hopefully, most of our listeners have had that opportunity to be the Grand Canyon. It is an amazing place, even if you can't raft it. But the difference in temperature between where they were on the north or the south rim and, you know, the canyon floor or the river is pretty stunning. I have been on the Grand Canyon at the south rim, I think, when it was snowing, and they said it was 80 degrees at the river. And so if you're there on a warm day at the top, you can imagine that it's the kind of day that Robin saw at the bottom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's typically like 20 to 30 degrees difference, depending on the season. Because one thing that people don't realize is how high the rims are.
Right.
I mean, the south rim is around 7,000 feet, and the north rim is 8,000 feet.
Right.
And at the river level, it's 2,000 feet. That altitude makes a huge temperature difference. Plus, inside the inner canyon, a lot of the rocks hold the heat and everything, too.
Right.
Robin was mentioning hiking and how hot it was and everything. That's actually something that river trips will adapt to. For example, a lot of my river trips that I've done have been in the spring or fall when the inner canyon temperatures are a little bit more moderate and it's more conducive to hiking and longer hikes away from the river. In the summertime, when it's much hotter, they tend not to do some hikes and do a little bit less hiking, and you'll spend more time playing in water and under waterfalls. So that's actually also a difference in that how many river trips will adapt what they do during the day to the current temperatures and season of the year.
And do you find that you have a favorite time of year to go in the Grand Canyon?
I would go anytime. However,
now it is seasonal, right?
It is seasonal. Yeah. And the fall, I think the fall, like for example, my upcoming trip will be late September into early October.
Okay.
There's a couple of reasons for that. One is the temperatures are more conducive to hiking, but also it's the non-motor season. So starting in, I believe it's early to mid-September, they don't allow motorboats on the river. And so it's only boats on the river are non-motor boats.
Okay.
It's less traffic on the river. It's just a lovely time to go. And usually the weather is pretty stable. I guess that brings up another thing is what is the rafting season? The private river trips will go year round because they will go whenever they can get a permit. But the commercial rafting season usually starts in late April into the end of September, early October. Okay. There are no commercial trips on the river in the winter months.
That was my understanding. Excellent. Let's lay out, as you start from east to west and you're going down the canyon, how is it going to change over the course of your trip?
Probably one of the most spectacular days for me was our third day in. They called it Rapids Day. And what it was is we were entering the gorge, which naive I was going in. I didn't realize that the canyon changes so much. So going into the gorge is this, you're just dropping significantly. So many more rapids throughout the day. We all wore our rain gear that day because we were going to get significantly wet. But the change in the rock, so it changes to this very dark gray. It's called Vishnu Sheets, which my understanding is it's about 1.6 billion years old is this rock. And then it has some granite going through it. So the appearance of the canyon just changes so significantly as you go into the gorge. As Rainer was saying before, much of the river is just kind of flat water and you're going along. This, there were times that I'm looking out from the front of the raft and it's looking like we're just going downhill. We're not in a rapid, but it's like you're boating downhill. It's just so steep. So that was a really different day and how the canyon looks so different compared to what we all see in the typical pictures.
Where you put in at Lee's Ferry, you can actually drive right to the river. That's what they do. They drive the equipment trucks right to the river.
I've driven out of the river at that spot.
You know, you have buttes around you and everything, but you don't get the feeling that you're in the canyon.
We actually saw wild horses there at that because it's just so open and they were grazing along. So,
As Robin was saying, as you start down through the canyon, it's kind of an optical illusion because, yes, the river obviously flows downhill and you're going down. But then the canyon walls start rising and cutting up. So you keep entering deeper and deeper into the canyon and the rock formations change. As Robin said on her trip, once you start hitting the inner gorge, you are down in the V-neck of a canyon. The scenery changes all the time from day to day.
Well, and you mentioned Lee's Ferry. Wasn't joking. I have pulled out of a raft at Lee's Ferry because you're basically an easy float trip down from the dam, whose name is escaping me for the moment.
Glen Canyon Dam.
Glen Canyon Dam, and you've just done a float trip down past Horseshoe Bend, which has gotten very famous relatively recently as a pretty picture spot. So since you're that close to Glen Canyon Dam, does the water level change during the day significantly? Because I know some dams will release water more at certain hours of the day.
That's a good question. Before the river was dammed, it was a wild river, and you get these huge fluctuations of the river volume in the summer and winter. You know, you'd have the the snow melt from the Rocky Mountains, and in the spring, the rivers would rise, and then by the end of the summer, it'd be very dry. Well, since Glen Canyon Damien was built, I believe they closed the floodgates like in 63 or 64, maybe a bit later in that. It really has changed the river a lot. One of the major things is the river is now a cold river because the water is released from the bottom of Glen Canyon Dam, from the very low part. It starts out at about, I don't know if it's like 48 to 50 degrees. So it's very cold. That's cold for a river. By the time you reach the end of the river, even in the middle of the summer, it's only warmed up to maybe 55. So that's changed the environment of the river, but also changed many of the seasonal fluctuations of the river. A lot of how much water is released, at least prior to the current drought, was based on the power consumption. It's electrical. Used for electrical power. And so when everyone was turning.
Well, and that's why it tends to change during the day, is there's more power consumption during sometimes the day.
What they actually found, though, back in the 90s and early 2000s was rise and lowering of the water levels in the day, and it was actually impacting the environment. So they have a lot of restrictions now on how much the water could be raised or lower to cut down on the impact on the environment. Grand Canyon Dam actually publishes what their intended river levels are going to be and how much use. So the guides know sure. this, and they have to plan accordingly where they park their boats at night, for example, because if the water drops in the middle of the night, all of a sudden the boats are landed and you have to get the boats back in the river.
Sure. Well, and then, Robin, you just did this trip in what is one of the worst droughts the West has seen ever. Well, at least since, you know, the days of the ancient Puebloan people, basically, at this point. Did the guides talk about that affecting the trip at all?
We asked them because we were expecting it to. And the only response we got was that, well, the water is better this week than last. So it did not seem to affect us. I mean, for us, it seemed like there was plenty of water. Okay. So it didn't seem to have an impact, but it does with that response. Certainly, it seems like it is varying from week to week what they're seeing.
Interesting.
The rapids change very much depending on the water level. Some rapids get easier, some rapids sure. get harder, and some don't get affected much at all by the, by the water level.
You know, what's interesting about the rapids, which I learned, is in the canyon, rapids are rated 1 through 10 versus the 1 through 5 on other rivers.
Really?
Yes. And so I don't know why. Randy, maybe you know why, but they give it a 1 through 10 rating instead.
Yeah, I actually don't know. It's a strange thing. For some reasons, rivers in the western U.S. seem to be like rated 1 through 10. But, you know, the international scale, as most people would know, is like 1 through 5.
Mm.
Okay. Yeah, and one being
easy.
You could do it on your float trip, and five being you better have a professional guide and you really better know what you're doing.
Yeah, I believe the term they use is consequences.
Yeah, exactly. Three and four are more my speed. Typical rapids in the Grand Canyon. What's the range then? If we put them on the 1 through 5 scale instead of the 1 through 10 scale.
If we do the 1 through 5 scale, there are some fives. I mean, there's one which I will say was my favorite, and it's Lava Falls, and it's a falls, not a rapid, they say, because of the steepness and how quickly you're declining as you go through it. So a couple of them are really significant. Randy, I would say that what I experienced with most would be around 2 to 3.
Yeah, I'd say 3 to 4. It's a very large volume river. It's a very safe river. Big volume of water and big fun rock and roll rapids. But as Robin said, the range go from a riffle, which is below a 1, up until a couple that are very large, 10s and 5 on the international scale.
Well, and it seems counterintuitive for you to say that there's a large volume of water and therefore it's safer.
Part of that is because there's so much water, it kind of creates a water cushion, and like in terms of rocks.
Mm-hmm.
At least most commercial river trips, you do not wear a helmet on the river, whereas a lot of smaller rivers you do. And I believe the thinking is that the volume of the river is so large that there's really very unlikely to hit rocks and you yourself hit rocks because there's just the cushion of water on almost everything.
Let's talk about the dangers, because we're talking about the rating of the rapids, and obviously the higher the number, the more fun, but also, you know, now you start to need to pay attention to what the guide is saying, especially if you're the one doing the paddling. Otherwise, you can end up, for instance, like the raft that you saw, Robin, that was wrapped. So what happens there often is you see this a lot in a paddle boat where you're trying to go around that rock and you don't quite get the right positioning upstream where you need to be here and you're over here. And so you end up where basically the raft goes up against a rock and the force of the water then is keeping it on that rock. Now you've gotten into dangerous territory too, because if it's a person, for instance, up against a rock and the force of water is there, that's where someone can be in some serious trouble. But it can also just be a real pain to try and get a raft off of that rock, because they don't turn off the river so that you can do that. And then the other dangers being, of course, if there are currents that will keep you down, if you fall in the water and out of the boat, they don't like that. They like you to stay in the boat. It's a little more fun that way. But you'll all get your safety briefing, I'm assuming, of if I fall out of the boat, what do I do?
Yeah, exactly. And that's why it's so important to wear a a PFD, personal flotation device, or life jacket. That's absolutely essential if you get thrown in. It's a very safe river as rivers go, and it's actually very safe river for a lot of other adventures. They often have done these studies of ranking rafting compared with other activities, and it's a very, very low. You're actually, the most dangerous thing you do on this trip is probably on land, actually. Getting stuck with a cactus or stumping your toe or falling or cutting yourself on a rock if you fall. Most injuries actually happen on land as opposed to in the water. As far as being in the water, I believe the biggest factor is hypothermia. Because, as I mentioned earlier, the river is so cold. Yep. You really don't want to be in it very long. They really want to get you out as soon as possible because, you know, 50-degree water doesn't sound that bad, but 50-degree water is actually pretty cold when you're in it. And you can actually start losing functionality, you know, within 2 or 3 minutes. So they want to get you out if you're in.
As someone who lives in a part of the world where the ocean is 50 degrees quite often, someone complained recently on the show, well, I'll talk about this actually in the community section of this show, that I sometimes talk about how great things are in California. One thing that's not great is our water is really cold. And we know the 50-50-50 rule, which is there, if you are in 50-degree water, you have a 50% chance of lasting 50 minutes before you get hypothermia. Little longer for some of us who have a little more insulation, but
that's what going through the rain gear, particularly in our raft where we were down in the front going through the rapids, you're getting very wet. The rain gear was really essential, and even with that, at times it was chilly. But if we didn't have that on and you got wet, you wanted to get out of that so that you could warm back up. From a rapids perspective, our raft had for every seat that you were, wherever you were positioned, they had a 2-hand hold, and they were pretty insistent that you made sure you had that 2-hand hold. And we did have one rapid that we went through. One woman lost her grip on one of her hands, and she kind of went flying, but fortunately into her neighbors instead of out into the water. So that was helpful. And I will say, to reinforce what Randy said, the only injury we had was on land. And I would say wear sandals wherever you are on land. You make sure your feet have something under them.
Well, and you mentioned the hypothermia. I think I was telling the two of you when we were doing that call that when I did the other trip I was talking about in the Dinosaur National Park and spent so much time in the kayaks, you're getting very wet. And again, river water that is very cold. But you're exerting yourself and you're keeping warm. And we stopped one time at lunch and I just started shivering. I was shivering uncontrollably, and they very quickly found a dry shirt for me and some towels and things because I didn't realize how much body heat I was losing to the river. So, yeah, it's cold.
Yeah, in fact, you know, when you go on one of these trips, the companies will give you a very extensive packing list of what to bring. One of the things they will tell you to bring is, you know, synthetic long underwear for exactly that reason, to get warmed up, even in the summer.
Now, Robin, you're 117 degrees where you're there. Are you wearing synthetic long underwear?
We were not. In fact, one of our biggest learnings in the trip was, and this again was not on the river but on land, but because of the heat, at night, where to put our cots. We actually never used tents because they said you can use the tents, but they're going to increase the temperature 10 to 15 degrees. So none of us ever used the tents. And I was like, okay, I'll, you know, go back closer to the canyon wall and we'll get a little privacy and set our cots up. Well, we quickly learned that, as Randy was saying earlier, those rocks hold the heat and radiate it out. So all night long, it's like you're sleeping in an oven. So the repeaters, which is interesting that Randy's going now for his 10th time. We had many people on our trip who were 8 or 10 time people. And we noticed that even the first night, they're sleeping down by the river. And we're like, what's that about? Well, we quickly learned that it's much cooler to sleep down by the river.
And you talk about packing. They're going to get a list from the operator that's going to have things like synthetic long underwear, and they're going to go, I don't understand, I'm going in the summer. What things are on that, and then what things are not on that that should be?
I would just say pack less than you think you need to.
Okay.
And I was only 6 days. So Randy's are probably a little bit different, but because things get heavy, you're taking things off the raft and you had a fire line every day, everyone's dry bag. So their duffel bags are in a dry bag with their sleeping bag. And there's a fire line that you're passing these through.
And you say a fire line, like a bucket brigade where you're passing your luggage to someone else.
Got it. And so we quickly knew by numbers who had packed too much and the rest of us were suffering for it. So don't pack as much as you think you might need to, but quick dry, we packed a lot of quick dry clothes, you know, long sleeves and long pants as well as shorts. And the rain gear was essential from our perspective, a hat, sunscreen. I would say the thing I didn't pack that I wish I had of was that I had some type of a coffee mug, because they had given us thermoses for water, which was also for coffee in the morning, but I would have preferred a mug. So that maybe shows you I'm not the true camper I seem to be on this trip.
You need very little. Usually the list of things that they tell you to bring is more than what you really need. Shorts and t-shirt, maybe like a long sleeve sun shirt, pretty much the things that Robin mentioned, but you quickly learn that you need very little, and they provide a lot of the things you need for daily life.
We heard who Robin went with. Randy, have you done all these trips with the same operator, or have you used multiple operators?
I have used multiple operators, and I guess when it comes to companies, it's interesting. There are currently about, I don't know, 12 or 13 different companies. They tend to have consolidated over the years. And the bottom line is they're all great, and you're going to have a great trip with any of them. In fact, what happens is someone goes on a trip and they comes back and say, wow, that was the best company ever. You need to go with them. Well, everyone says that about the company that they go with. They're all excellent. If we're actually mentioning companies, well, let me back up a minute before I say that is some companies tend to specialize in motor only trips. Some companies tend to specialize in just non-motor trips. And then some companies have a whole gamut of all types of trips. And so you really probably want to look at all the companies and all their information and what they offer. But in terms of specific companies that I've gone with, the ones that I've gone and really liked are ASRA, which is Arizona Raft Adventures. I've gone with Canyon Explorations. I've gone with Tour West. And I've gone with Oars as well. And then I actually have some guide friends. It's not uncommon for what some guys might do is they want to bring a bunch of their friends on a commercial trip. They will actually buy the whole trip. They call it a charter trip. A number of my trips have actually been charter trips where a bunch of friends have gotten together and essentially bought a commercial trip.
Interesting. And so you are choosing, as you choose your next trip, by availability or by...
I got an email from one of my rafting guides friend and said, hey, I'm gonna do this charter trip 2 years from now. Would you like to go? And I always jump at the chance and opportunity. So it actually picked me as opposed to me picking it.
That's funny.
As far as if someone was looking for at least a non-motor trip, I would kind of steer them to look at ASRA or Canyon Explorations. But I think they're all great.
It's interesting, Chris, on our trip, there was a group that had done it and they do it regularly. And it's so funny that now we are on their email list as they're booking now in 2023. They're like, do you want to be on the list? So it's pretty common that it just starts to be these repeaters because it is such a fantastic experience.
Do you have your next trip booked already?
Not yet. He doesn't have the dates yet, but we're thinking about it. The other piece that truly I didn't expect that for me made it so amazing is the peacefulness. I mean, you are completely disconnected from the phone, from texting, from everything. And even though we were with, so probably our group was larger than what Randy's experienced. We were 37 people. You still had so much time to yourself and it was so peaceful. And the river is not crowded. It's interesting to hear that, you know, at some point the motorized boats are cut off because it's not as if you see many boats during the day at all. And I came away, and I think a lot of people came away with just this sense of renewal because it was completely quiet. I mean, there are times that you could just be in just complete silence at the bottom of that canyon. It was beautiful.
Yeah, you may only see two or three other trips during the day. Mm-hmm. It's not like you're seeing a bunch of all the time. The other thing that's kind of interesting is they don't know where they're going to camp every night. Mm. Yeah, they kind of make it.
Oh, I did not
they
know
make
that.
It, okay. You know, unlike, I believe it's the Salmon River in Idaho, their camps uh-huh. are actually reserved ahead of time. On this trip, right. when you leave in the morning, it just depends what the plan is for the day and how things go and where they end up. And during the day, if they encounter other trips on the river, the guides will talk. And they'll say, hey, where are you planning to go tonight? What's your plans? And so there's a lot of cooperation on the river to figure out where people can. There's a lots of camps and lots of opportunities, but there are some parts that have fewer camps, so there's less options. So the companies work together to kind of figure out where they're going to end up for the night.
Yeah, so we experienced the same thing. That was unexpected to me, that we didn't know we were going to camp every night. Yeah.
That's the beauty of it, too. You're mm-hmm. just living off the cuff, and you're not adhered to a schedule.
And then, Randy, you're doing this on the non-motorized. What's the typical group size that you're seeing? Like four rafts and 24 people or something like that?
Maybe like four or five oar boats and a paddle boat. So like five or six rafts, probably about 20 people. 20 passengers and maybe five guides, 25 people total.
Well, and then they're doing the cooking.
Mm-hmm.
They're setting up toilet facilities such as they are. You're pitching your tent if you're pitching a tent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And I will say the most scenic toilet facility you might ever have in your life. The most beautiful spot you could ever imagine.
It is pretty much the reason why my wife will never do this trip.
That is very true. That what's very key to a camp is the placement of the facilities. And it's usually in one of the most beautiful, picturesque views you can find, and usually overlooking the river. As other river trips go by, you can wave to them as you're sitting there.
Well, I didn't have that experience, thankfully. I just had a beautiful scene.
Yeah, Robin is actually exactly right about the food. It's fantastic. They do an incredible job of cooking, and I eat much better on the river than I do at home in many ways. Typically, cooked breakfast in the morning, which might be eggs to order, French toast, pancakes, fruits, yogurt, pretty much anything you would want. Usually in the middle of the day, sometime in the middle of the day, depending what they're doing, they'll pull over to the side to a beach and set up and maybe have some cold cut sandwiches or more of a picnic style lunch. And then in the evening, when they have the camp set up and they have their kitchen all set up, they'll have a fully cooked meal, which could be anything from lasagna to any type of dish. They do some incredible cooking in Dutch ovens, for mm-hmm. example.
Mm-hmm. We had trout. The last night was a very special night. We had shrimp cocktail and then steak. We had ice cream. I mean, the food really is amazing. And that was one of the most impressive things to me is how they, on these J-rigs, they pack all the supplies and all the food. Our trip was only 6 days, but it was packed for 9 days because as we helicoptered out, another group helicoptered in for the following 3 days to finish up the rest of the river. So when we left Lee's Ferry, everything that was needed was on those two rafts with 37 people. And that just impressed me so much. The guides are amazing.
Yeah, that's actually true of the smaller boats, too. So on these 17, 18 day trips, we're never resupplied with food or ice or anything.
Hmm. Impressive.
Yeah. Does that mean the menu changes as you get further along in the trip here?
That part of the trip is very much scheduled. The way they pack their coolers and freezers, they actually have it staged so that they'll use a lot of the stuff they need for the early part of the trip on the top.
Sure.
And so they will use food and things that might have a shorter time for being kept earlier in the trip than later in the trip. You're still going to have great food by the end of the trip, but the lettuce might be starting to wilt a little bit.
Interesting. What else do people need to know before they book their trip for the Grand Canyon?
One thing that I would like to point out is some of the options for not necessarily the type of trip, mm-hmm. but the length of trip and the section of the river. Both Robin and I have been talking about a trip where we essentially went near the whole length of the river. Mm-hmm. There are other options. For example, all river trips start at Lee's Ferry, but some people will go as far as Phantom Ranch, mm-hmm. which is the main part of Grand Canyon where people hike down the Bright Angel Trail to right. Phantom Ranch. So you can do a rafting trip, and they refer to that as the upper part of the river or the first half of the river, mm-hmm. even though it's really not half. It's about 80 miles downstream. So you can book a trip where you travel from Lee's Ferry to near Phantom Ranch, but then you have to hike out. It's a 10-mile, 5,000-foot climb, and it's a significant hard hike. But you can do the upper half of the river where you hike out, or you can do a trip where you hike down at the same point, meet a rafting trip, and then do the lower half of the river. So they would call that an exchange trip, where they're exchanging passengers in the middle of the trip. Kind of like when Robin referred to Whitmore Wash at mile 188, where she helicoptered out, they had people coming in and joining the trip. So there's these different sections of the river that you can do. You don't have to do the whole trip. I highly recommend the whole trip for a variety of reasons. But because of people's vacation time and limits, sure. that's why. So, you know, you can do the whole, pretty much the whole trip in a motorboat in, you know, a week or a little bit more than a week, or you can do like the upper half of the river in a non-motor trip in, say, roughly a week, or the lower trip in a week. But that's why it's going to take 2 weeks or more to do the whole trip in a non-motor trip. So there are all these options. If you plan to do an upper or lower trip, you really need to be aware of what's involved with that hike in and out. It's not necessarily an easy hike.
Well, and the prices is going to range based on the length more than anything else, it appears, and roughly in the range of every 7 days is about $3,000. Am I in the right ballpark?
I would say roughly, yes, $3,000 to $3,500.
Okay. Like everything else, the prices have gone up a lot over the years. I mean, I remember my very first trip was in 1991. And I remember my 13-day trip, I believe, was in around $1,600. Mm-hmm. And now that same trip is $5,000 or more. So.
I would say as far as preparation, just to recognize you're camping. I had a friend who went on the trip and she said to me, she goes, this is not glamping. This is camping. I mean, you're truly camping. And so to be prepared for that, which is great fun. And then the one tip I got from the office, actually, as I called them and thinking about the heat, that she said, bring a sarong, you know, for a woman is one of those wraps, but certainly a man could come up with something similar or use a sarong. And because like, if you are wearing shorts, it's hot during the day, that you can dip in the water and then just put over you. Mm-hmm. And that was a tremendous help to have something you can dip in the water to put over you. And then certainly a good hat and sunscreen.
I have my sarong as well for my trip.
Good.
yeah, one thing, it's kind of
okay,
have you.
So I would pay money to see those pictures.
Actually, my sarong came from Fiji. So, but anyhow, you kind of have your clothes you wear on the river during the day.
Yep.
And then once you get into camp, you want to get out of those wet clothes and let them dry. And then you typically have a change of clothes for your evening wear, so to speak. You want to get into dry clothes in the evening and enjoy camp, but you don't need a lot of stuff. You know, you can use the same clothes over and over every day, but it's enjoyable to have, keep your river clothes separate from your camp clothes.
Yeah. And then I would say some things not to bring. I was thinking we might need some snacks. We were provided snacks during the day, so we didn't need any snacks. I had brought some nuts in Ziploc bags. Well, one night while sleeping, had not zipped my duffel, and a few little desert mice found their way into my duffel and my nuts that were my Ziploc bag. So no need to bring any of those snacks unless they're secured better than my were.
Got it.
Yeah, they provide all the food and snacks you'll want to need.
Yes.
As we start to wrap this up, you're standing in the prettiest spot in the Grand Canyon. Where, or possibly you're sitting, where are you and what are you looking at? First, Rob and you.
Probably the most, I'm going to use prettiest in a unique way, the mm-hmm. most inspirational spot for me that was just completely moving. We had in that rock area with all the Vishnu sheets, two rafts were able to move into a side little pocket. They called it the reading room. And we were just tucked in there with the motors off. It was completely silent. The walls are probably, 50 to 70 feet high. So just completely quiet. And we sat for a while. And then one of the guides read a story about one of the early explorers of the river. And then another guide broke out his harmonica and played. And it just was beautiful. So that was probably the prettiest spot from an absolutely amazing, amazing experience to be there.
Randy, you've got more trips to think about here. So we gave you more time.
This is so difficult, but one of my favorite places is the Nanka Wheat Granaries. It's a classic spot. You've most likely have seen pictures of this thing. You hike up from the river, maybe like 500 feet or so, and you're at the edge of this rock side. There's these old granaries, and it's just a classic view looking straight down the river. You see the light reflecting off the meandering Colorado River as you look straight down through the gorge. So it's that view from the Nanka Wheat Granaries looking downriver. This view is on the quarter. They did the state quarters a number of years ago. All the states in the U.S. had quarters, commemorative quarters. And that view from the Nanka Wheat Granaries is on the back of the Arizona quarter.
Interesting. Excellent. One thing that makes you laugh and say only on a Grand Canyon rafting trip.
The view from the toilet.
Only on a Grand Canyon rafting trip can I collapse on the beach at the end of my long hike, exhausted, and say, man, that was great.
Excellent. And if you had to summarize the trip, we'll give you three words each. Starting ladies first, Robin.
I'm going to say breathtaking, humbling, and inspiring.
And Randy.
Beauty. Tranquility, chaos.
Chaos, okay.
Chaos when you're in the middle of a rapid and the waves are coming at you from every direction.
Okay, I get that. does raise the blood pressure and the heart rate a little bit in the middle of that, which is one of the reasons that it makes it interesting. Excellent. Our guests again are Randy and Robin. Now, Robin, you've written up some of your trip on your blog. Why don't you tell us where your blog is and what you normally blog about?
My blog is on perry.coach, and I am a leadership and professional coach. So I most recently wrote a blog about this adventure and how it provides new perspective.
Excellent. I enjoyed it. I don't know if I read the whole thing yet. I got distracted by one of the other blog posts on what you learned from a pastor's funeral. So that was also an interesting post. And then, Randy, I don't think you've got any write-ups about this yet. You're going to do some for Amateur Traveler, right?
I might be able to coerce. No, I don't have any write-ups on it. All my experiences are kind of kept in my soul right now.
All right. Well, thank you for sharing your soul with us, and thank you both for coming on Amateur Traveler. Well, and supporting Amateur Traveler. Let's say that too, as long as I've got you here. But for coming on Amateur Traveler and sharing with us your love for the Grand Canyon.
And have a great trip coming up, Randy. I'm envious.
Thank you. And thank you, Robin. And thank you for having us on, Chris.
Yes. Thank you, Chris, so much. Great job always.
This is the point in the show where I usually thank the patrons of the show. I have two in particular that I can think of right now. Special thanks to Randy and to Robin, who have been supporting the show. And you can now see why I am enjoying the monthly conversations that we have with the patrons. And some things come out of those as well. If you're interested in supporting the show, you can go to patreon.com/amateurtraveler. I mentioned during the show that I had a recent review on Apple Podcasts about the show. It was a 3-star review, a little lower than I'm usually shooting for, from Natelikel, saying, "I like it, but not the California comparisons. I really enjoy hearing about different places around the world. I like the format of the show, too. But Chris is consistently belittling the places guests talk about. If someone says there are wineries in their location, Chris has to mention that he's from California and ask, but how's the wine? I've heard this many times. In the Cleveland episode, Chris just had to mention the shark tunnels aren't unique to Cleveland. Why does he have to put down places?" I feel like I should respond to this. I'm not intending to put down places. One of the reasons that I do the show is I like so many places. I really love some of the episodes we've done. And let's just focus on domestic US right now. International, it's true as well. But I love some of the things that we've done. For instance, I like doing the Cleveland episode because I don't think Cleveland gets enough love. You know, I don't think that a lot of people think of Cleveland as a place to vacation, and that's why I want to do those kind of shows, especially on the industrial heartland, on the South, and some of those places that I'm not from. I am going to continue to pick on the wine because if you're going to make wine, you've got to be ready to be compared to California, to Chile, to France, to all of those places, and not everybody makes as good a wine. Now, in terms of the shark tunnels, the guest said that there was the only place they'd seen shark tunnels. Well, it's not the only place. I wasn't trying to put down Cleveland. I think shark tunnels are cool, but they are in other places. And I'm just trying to make sure that we're as factually accurate as possible. I've had to correct well-known guests, too, who have said things that are just not true. But no, I love other places. And I mentioned in either this episode or one of the ones we're doing, there are some things that California does not do as well. So let's talk about those. I live in an area of California where the beaches are lovely, but pretty much any beach on the southeastern United States or the Gulf Coast is going to have warmer water and a lot more fun to get in the water because it is cold where I live. If you're looking for fall, we're going to talk about a place that's really good for fall coming up on the show. If you're looking for fall color, you don't go to California. That's not what we're good at. There are many places in the U.S. that we talk about the fall color. We've talked about that recently with the Blue Ridge Parkway, but we're going to talk about it with New Hampshire coming up on the show. But really, there are so many places that it's better. I like the barbecue in California much better in Texas. You know, if you're looking for wine, go to California. Looking for bourbon, you know, you better be talking about Kentucky. And I'm going to get in trouble with people from California when you talk about regional hamburgers. I'm not a big fan of In-N-Out. I'm sorry. Their fries are just really not that good and their burgers are okay. So your local place is probably better. And don't get me started on the cost of housing out here. I have lots of opinions. I think my favorite national park is in Utah. My favorite food probably in New Mexico or in New Orleans. I think people are nice all over, but I have a soft spot for the Midwest where my family's from. And my wife makes fun at me because I get a newsletter about Southern cooking. So there are really a lot of things that are good in other places. And that's one of the reasons I do the show is really I enjoy the traveling everywhere I go. So I'm sorry, so sorry if that came across as belittling. I thought it would go without saying that the only way that a show ends up on Amateur Traveler is I think it's interesting and worth traveling to. But let me say it again. If a show ends up on Amateur Traveler and we're talking about a destination, I think it's interesting and worth traveling to. With that, we're going to end this episode of Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com, and thanks so much for listening.